DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress with me, Sarah Steffen. This week we go to the world's first refugee camp that's powered by solar energy, Azraq in Jordan. And some refugees helped build the plant.
It's a beautiful feeling. I can't describe it. When we did the first test and it worked, we were all emotional. I'm so happy. I'm so proud.
We also hear how Beirut's LGBT community is doing after they've received threats for putting on the first gay pride event in the Arab world.
They thought that if they would attack the first event, all the others would collapse. However, some of the other activities have continued and they were packed.
We also hear about a new craze called camel milk, so stick around. But let's go to Australia first. This week marks the 50th anniversary of a referendum where people voted yes to finally include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the census. It's seen as a landmark decision in the struggle for equal rights for Australia's Indigenous people, who had long been considered second-class citizens. What change did the referendum bring, and how are Aboriginal people faring today? Barry Mackay has the story.
Since the early days of colonisation, when British settlers arrived in Australia in 1788, Australia has arguably had one of the most controversial track records of its treatment of its Indigenous peoples, says Professor Mick Dodson, an Aboriginal lawyer and one of Australia's best-known Indigenous rights advocates.
The advent of the First Fleet began a long and bloody dispossession of Indigenous people, not just only of their lands. There was massive destruction of peoples through wars that were fought over 160 years.
Those who survived were, over time, forced to assimilate with the new white colonies. In 1901, when Australia federated, the newly written constitution stated that Aboriginal people were not to be counted in the census, and the Australian Commonwealth could make laws with respect to, quote, the people of any race other than the Aboriginal race in any state, for whom it is deemed necessary to make special law. Each state of Australia had its own so-called Aboriginal Protection Board, restricting the residence of the majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. All aspects of their lives were controlled by state bureaucrats, such as marriage, travel, employment, personal finances, and access to education and health services. In many cases, children were forcibly removed from parents to assimilate them with white Australia.
Probably from the late 20s, the policy towards Aboriginal people was primarily assimilation. It gained momentum in the 1950s, really, and it was sort of full federal and state policy by the 1960s. And that was essentially, you know, turn Aboriginal people into white fellas.
In 1957, a group headed by activist Faith Bandler started a campaign to give Aboriginal people the same rights under the Constitution as other races and to end the discrimination enshrined by law. Aboriginal people were given the right to vote in 1962. In 1965, inspired by the civil rights movement in the United States, the first Aboriginal graduate from Sydney University, Charles Perkins, led a group of Aboriginal people and university students through areas of New South Wales where racism was most pronounced on what was to become known as the Freedom Ride. On the 27th of May 1967, a referendum was held to amend the Constitution to include Aboriginal people in the census and allow the Australian Commonwealth to create laws for them, giving them citizenship.
Vote yes for Aborigines, they want to be Australians too. Vote yes and give them rights and freedoms just like me and you.
I feel that the time has come when Australia can no longer tolerate legal racial discrimination against its Indigenous people.
And it was the most successful referendum in Australian constitutional history. And people had high hopes that that would deliver a brand new day for Aboriginal people. But that is not how things panned out.
Overall, living standards today have largely improved for a majority of Indigenous Australians, but there are still a number of challenges. The official 2017 Closing the Gap report, looking at health and education outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, found that Australia is still not on target for 6 out of 7 key goals, such as life expectancy, child mortality, employment, reading and writing, and school attendance. Even though Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people only make up a small percentage of Australia's total population, about 2%, over a quarter of the total Australian prison population are Indigenous. The number of Aboriginal deaths in custody is also disturbingly high.
Always was, always will be!
Aboriginal land!
Always was, always will be!
Aboriginal land!
An estimated 10,000 people marched through the streets of Sydney on the 26th of January this year, Australia Day, which celebrates the date of the arrival of the British colonists in 1788. The protest aimed to highlight injustices and human rights abuses against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians and called on the government to drop the date of Australia's National Day.
The invasion is still happening. This is not a thing of the past. Our peoples are still being invaded. In recent years, I'm proud to say we've had a very, very big shift, which we witnessed today and last year. We had thousands, as we do today, we'll have thousands marching with us under the banner of Invasion Day. So we're seeing Australia as a country starting to wake up to this scam called Australia Day. When it is clear, if they take the trouble to find out, within 2 years, over 70% of the Eora people were killed off, either by disease or direct warfare. That is not a day to celebrate.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people still have not been recognised in the Constitution as Australia's First Nations peoples. This is politically contentious. There is concern amongst some conservatives that rather than being symbolic, recognition would give Indigenous communities special status compared to the rest of the Australian community. The exact wording of such an acknowledgement raises concerns that if Indigenous people's power was constitutionally entrenched, that may then create unforeseen rights that could be challenged in the courts, such as further land claims or a guaranteed number of seats in Parliament. For many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, the goal is not constitutional recognition, but a treaty or sovereignty. This would give Aboriginal people, as the previous owners of the land, fundamental political and legal rights to negotiate with the government. But this issue is not likely to be solved anytime soon, says Professor Mick Dodson.
We've got to free our hearts from this scourge that's been our colonial history. We've got to own up to it as a country, that it was bad. We're sorry about that, and we want to do something about it. So can we sit down and talk about that? And I'd be saying, well, let's have an agreement and let's share some power.
Barry Mackay, DW, Sydney.
A refugee camp in Jordan has become the first in the world to be powered by renewable energy. The solar-powered Asrak camp is now changing the lives of some 20,000 Syrian refugees. Last week, the UN Refugee Agency and its partners switched on that solar power plant that some of the refugees helped build. Dale Gavlak traveled to the desert facility to have a look.
Syrian refugee Omar Hamid and her family have had their fortunes change overnight in Asrak camp, a refugee camp that lies in the Jordanian desert, some 100 kilometers east of the capital Amman. Mohammed's family now has access to electricity, all day and every day. As summer approaches, that means a fan to cope with the desert heat and a heater for winter's penetrating cold.
Of course, a big difference between now and before. Electricity is a new life, good life. I wash my clothes by hand. But now I have a washing machine inside my shelter. The weather here is very, very hot. Ramadan is coming, and for that, the fasting is very, very, very difficult for us. But now I hope to be good because electricity, fun, TV, cold water.
Before the advent of electricity at his caravan, neighbor Talal Mahsen says he and his family, who have been in Azraq for the past year after fleeing the Aleppo countryside, had to put on wet cloths on their bodies just to cool off in the punishing summer heat. For the past 2.5 years, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the camp's residents only had sporadic access to electricity. And for the past 2.5 years, Syrian refugees had been living with the sole support of solar lanterns distributed on their arrival and streetlights installed in just one part of the camp. UNHCR representative to Jordan, Stefano Severes, says the cheap electricity will help refugee children study and allow women to safely walk to the bathrooms in the dark, while aiding families and small businesses needing refrigeration and lighting.
The importance of electricity goes well beyond mere comfort. It impacts their security, health, education, and helps provide an improved quality of life while away from home.
The Swedish IKEA Foundation funded the nearly 9 million euro solar plant at Azraq. It's something of a prototype project hoped to be used in refugee settings in 9 other countries. IKEA Foundation CEO Per Hagenis says the UN private sector partnership is a win-win project, saving money and the environment.
We are saving the world from thousands of tons of CO2 emissions by relying on renewable energy. And that's very important in today's world and can reduce the impact climate change has on the community. What we achieve is actually a huge cost savings. UNHCR will save about $1.5 million every year on energy because it gets produced by renewable sources right around us here.
That's money, they say, that can be used on educational, health and development programs for the refugees, such as maintaining shelters exposed to the harsh elements. More than 50 Syrian refugees were also trained and employed to help build the solar plant, including Abdullah Saleh Hawass, who shares the excitement they feel over installing solar power to bring along electricity.
It's a beautiful feeling. I can't describe it. When we did the first test and it worked, we were all emotional, screaming, cheering, laughing, some were even crying. It's a feeling I can't describe to you in words. I'm so happy. I'm so proud.
Although Hawass trained as an electrician in Syria, it was a far cry from the work he's had while in the camp, from registering newcomers to collecting rubbish. Often he just sat at home without a job. Hawass served as the chief engineer among the Syrians employed on the project carried out by the Jordanian firm Mustaqbal, or Future. His boss, Mustaqbal's Ala Koban, says it's taken time to introduce renewable energy to Jordan, despite the abundance of sunshine and wind, because the necessary legislation first had to be in place and the money made available.
Since 3 or 4 years, the legislation was developed to develop renewable energy plants in Jordan. And so it's happening at the right time. Maybe it could have happened before, but I believe these things take time. But we should be proud that compared to the Gulf, compared to the region around Jordan, we were at the beginning of the curve. It's a 2 megawatt plant. It'll produce around 3.6 million kilowatt hours a year. So once the refugees turn to their homeland, this power plant will remain here and as a contribution to Jordan to reduce their dependence on foreign fuel supplies.
Kuban says the solar plant will, in a couple of months, be upgraded from 2 to 5 megawatts. And that will provide electricity to Azraq's remaining 15,000 Syrian refugees, who, like Sami, says it's hard to keep food from spoiling now with the approach of summer. Meanwhile, Jordan's largest camp for Syrian refugees at Zatari is expected to get a 12-megawatt solar plant in the months ahead. For DW, I'm Del Gavlak in Azraq Camp, Jordan.
You're listening to DW's World in Progress, coming to you from Bonn, Germany. You can find more of our content online and on our Facebook page, DW Global Society. Last week, Lebanon's capital, Beirut, hosted the first gay pride festival in the Arab world. However, some of the events of the one-week-long festival aimed at ending discrimination against the LGBT community didn't go ahead as planned. Some events were cancelled after threats by Islamists. Suniva Rose reports.
Music, discussions and drag queen shows, that's what the organizers of the Beirut Pride, the first in the Arab world, had in mind. The activists wanted to bring people together and celebrate the LGBT community, but threats interrupted its activities before they even kicked off. After menacing messages were published on social media by the Ulema, a conservative association of Muslim scholars, the hotel that was supposed to host the launch of Beirut Pride pulled out the day before it was scheduled.
The threats were simple. They were posting over their official webpage. The first statement was to ask the government to interfere. However, a bit in the afternoon, they posted another threat saying if the government will not stop these activities, they will send their supporters, those who would defend religious ethics, to interfere themselves and stop it.
That's Berto Maxo, director of Proud Lebanon, the pro-LGBT NGO that had organized the event that was supposed to launch Beirut Pride.
Well, we knew from the hotel that the authorities have informed them that there will be demonstrations at the entrance of the hotel and that the security of the hotel would not provide us with protection. It was the first time since we started that we faced this kind of threats.
Do you think if you'd held it anyway, they would have come?
Well, because they were like calling us until Monday to know if we moved anywhere else. So we believe for sure they would have showed up. But we were blaming the government because we are Lebanese citizens and we were supposed to get protection like anyone else.
Berto Maxo looked for another host for his event but couldn't find anything on such short notice.
They thought that if they would attack the first event, all the others would collapse. However, some of the other activities have continued, and they were packed.
Homosexuality is still illegal under Law 534 in Lebanon's Penal Code, which says sexual acts that contradict the order of nature can mean up to a year in jail. There have been several court cases since 2009, however, in which judges have ruled in favor of the LGBT community. But according to Maxo, despite these hopeful decisions in court, the majority of Lebanese society still rejects the LGBT community.
Being an LGBT in Lebanon, it's true that you find some more tolerant individuals. However, the majority is, especially recently, it's becoming more and more conservative, maybe due to the war around us. We've seen people attacking houses where there were like LGBT refugees staying in. We've seen people arrested on the Corniche just because they suspected they are transsexuals, and when they checked their IDs, they realized that they are men. However, they look as women, so they arrested them. You know, it's not easy.
The Corniche, a cliffside road that Berto Maxo is referring to, is a popular pedestrian area by the sea where Beirutis like to go for a walk, smoke shisha or fish. People from all social backgrounds and generations mingle here. I went to ask them what they thought of Beirut Pride.
The gay people are a part of the community, so we cannot ignore them just because you are not gay people. No, no, it's normal. No, God make them like this, so no. We should accept them the way they are.
For me, I'm not against this activity. Each one, he has his own freedom.
I'm definitely against it. It should not be happening. This is something very bad.
Another prominent NGO, Helm, received threats against a talk they had organized in a popular theater. They moved it to a confidential location and broadcast it live online instead. This event was the second and last one to be dropped out of 28 in total, organized by Beirut Pride. But it was the first time Helm cancelled one of their events.
In 2012, when we had the protest, when we had the anti-gay protest in front of us by a group of youth, the police was there. But this time, I think that the ulama, they lobbied. I mean, we saw a post on their Facebook that they met the Minister of Interior and the head of the General Security the day on the 17th of May, which is the International Day Against Homophobia. And 2 days later, the event of Helm was scheduled, and it was the government sent a clear message, we will not protect you.
Georges Azzi is one of the co-founders of Helm. The government did not issue any public comment on the event's cancellation. But according to Georges Azzi, the theatre was unofficially informed by General Security, Lebanon's intelligence agency, that they would not be receiving protection. There was quite a blow for the NGO community, but they have now decided to take an outspoken stance against religious extremism.
Enough is enough. And it's not only the position of the LGBT community, but every liberal, every artist who had to deal with censorship, every person who wants to live different than the norms imposed by religion, I think they feel concerned by what happened today.
The situation is still incomparably better to what it was a decade ago. Take Naji, for instance, who was denounced and arrested when he downloaded a gay porn movie on the internet. He was only 19 then, and that was 10 years ago.
So what happened is they called my mom came, and they outed me in front of my mom in a really awful way in a prison. And I was imprisoned for a couple of days, and they did anal tests on me to figure out if I'm gay or not.
What do you mean by anal?
Anal tests is that they bring an object and they insert it anally to see if I'm accessibly easy to have these kind of sexual relationship with men.
That practice has been banned since. Today, Naji says the gay community feels more empowered. Every year for the last 13 years, he's participated in celebrations revolving around the International Day Against Homophobia.
But this year, because of this boom in social media, the freedoms, Beirut is much more lighter now. And even you can kiss anywhere publicly with my friends. It happened, and nobody really...
Does it depend on when you are?
Yes, of course. In central Beirut, it's easy. But on the outskirts, in the villages, it's not really that acceptable.
Even though those that threaten Beirut Pride will most probably remain unpunished, the event was deemed a success by its organizer, Hadi Damian. He says he received messages to show support from every corner of the Middle East, from Bahrain to Morocco. Suniva Rose, DW, Beirut.
Our last story takes us to Kenya. Have you ever tried camel milk? It's supposed to have 3 times more vitamin C than ordinary cow milk. But that's not the main reason why it's catching on in Kenya. Some farmers in the drought-ridden East African country are keeping camels now because they're much more drought-resistant than cows. Andrea Dijkstra has more.
Maria Malem inspects her herd of camels in the fields outside of Isiolo, a provincial town about a 5-hour drive north of the capital of Nairobi. Although the landscape is extremely dry and sandy, her camels still manage to find some food. They nibble at arrowroot bushes while the wooden bells around their necks softly tingle.
My husband and I had over 100 cattle until 2005, but as the climate became drier in this region, the cows stopped producing milk. Every year, 20 to 30 of our cows died. This made us decide to shift to camels, as they survive without water for over 2 weeks. They continue to give milk, and although they become weak and skinny, they won't die.
Together with her herdsmen, 45-year-old Mariam gets the camels ready for milking. She bends over one of the animals, grasps a teat, and squeezes it. The milk flows into a metal bucket underneath the camel. Selling the camel milk really changed her life, Mariam tells me, while she continues to milk her camels.
In the past, I couldn't go to school due to financial problems, but thanks to the profits of the camel milk, I was able to send my 8 children to school. One of them now even goes to university. With the money I saved, I built my own house. I now even employ 10 people who herd the camels and take care of transporting the milk.
The sound of women shouting and the rumbling of jerrycans fill the camel milk distribution center in Isiolo, founded by Mariam and around 30 other local women 5 years ago.
This is where they sip our milk.
That's Gerald Muriti, the manager of the center, who receives around 5,000 liters of camel milk a day that's brought in by the women. After he has tested the milk's quality, he pumps it into an enormous cooling tank for storage. The women receive assistance from the Dutch development organization SMV that help them, for example, with financing the cooling tank. Since milking is considered a women's affair, the camel milk business directly improves the lives of the women, says Harm Duiker, country director of SMV Kenya.
Yeah, we see a lot of impact because they are selling more milk and they are getting better prices. And they use the income for schooling of their children. And what we also have seen is that some of the women, they start buying camels. And that, of course, is giving them even more benefits.
Mariam, who has been in the camel business for 5 years now, can feel the change in her community.
Because we now earn our own incomes, we have a bigger say and even receive more respect in the community. Earlier, many of us were unemployed, but now we've become successful businesswomen.
People estimate there are now around 3 million camels in Kenya. 3 times as many as a decade ago, as more and more Kenyans start keeping them, says Piers Simkin, a camel expert who has studied the animals for over 30 years. They have caught on because they are extremely drought resistant, he says.
In a bad drought, a cattle owner will lose 50% of his herd. But with camels, it's rare for people to lose more than 16, maximum 20% of the camel herd in a drought.
Besides the drought resistance of camels, it's also the better price farmers get for the milk that attracts camel owners.
Sometimes you get $1 a litre, but for a cow producer, you're probably getting 20 cents per litre. And if I'm getting 100 shillings, 5 times the price of cow's milk, it's of interest to many people to start producing.
However, a camel also costs about 6 times as much as a cow. Camels have become so popular that even the Maasai have gotten in on camel milk. Traditionally, cows play an important role in the Maasai culture, and camels are considered ugly animals by some in the tribe. But still, even some Maasai have started keeping camels, as the climate in our region in the south of Kenya is becoming drier. Ole and Kiyu, a 54-year-old Maasai with a red checkered blanket around his shoulders, decided to buy camels after almost half of his 190 cows died during a severe drought. That was 8 years ago. He and his brother Samuel Maya now don't just keep the camels for their milk, but also use them as draft animals for farming. Behind his house, made of cow dung and straw, Samuel puts a harness on one of the camels and attaches a metal cart that he uses to collect cow dung as fertilizer for farming.
Camels are extremely strong. I even used one to excavate a piece of land and to construct a dam to stock water.
Not all Maasai are very excited about camels, though, like the father of Joshua Saruni, the 90-year-old neighbor of Samuel and Ole.
My father doesn't like camels because of the belief they bring drought.
Samuel Maya explains there is a severe superstition about camels among Maasai.
Some years ago, Somali immigrants came into our land with many camels. That same year, the region was hit by a severe drought. And since then, many Maasai believe that camels cause drought.
Joshua Saruni thinks that among the younger generations, the superstition might vanish, though.
We change, especially our young generations, because most of them, they go to school.
Back at the distribution center in Isiolo at 5 a.m., where men are already busy loading cans with camel milk onto passenger buses. But as the milk often got stolen or run bad when buses break down, the women are now trying to get a loan to buy their own cooling truck to transport the milk to Nairobi. Andrea Dijkstra for DW in Isiolo, Kenya.
And that's all we had time for today on World in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/World in Progress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliane Gigliaducci and Jürgen Kuhn. I'm Sarah Steffen, and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.